Hi, it's Rod McClure here again, and no telephone this time, so we don't have to worry about things not quite working. We've been reading Ivanhoe, and we'll continue with that today. I hope you're enjoying it. And before we go any further, word from our sponsors.
The Araluen Valley Hotel offers visitors and locals a welcoming bar with cold beer on tap, a games room and a beer garden. Open 5 days a week, Wednesday to Sunday, with delicious Sunday roasts at lunch and dinner. Bistro meals serve from 12 to 2pm and 6 to 8pm. Strictly observing COVID guidelines, every visitor is required to register on entry by digital sign-on. Araluen Valley Hotel. Find us on Facebook or phone 4846 4023. Supporting our local radio station, Braidwood FM 88.9.
At the Braidwood Servicemen's Club, you can enjoy a range of activities designed to provide something for everyone. Enjoy a round of golf on a 9-hole golf course or a game of bowl, squash or pool. Friday night entertainment a couple of times a month and sport and music channels on big screen TVs. Or have a Chinese or Australian meal at the restaurant. Braidwood Servicemen's Club, 48422108. Proud sponsors of Braidwood Community Radio.
For all your plumbing and gas fitting needs, Braidwood and Districts Plumbing is here to help.
They can assist with hot water installations and repairs, new builds and renovations,
block drains, septic system installations and repairs, and all other plumbing services.
They also offer 1.7 to 5.5 tonne excavator and tipper hire, and are fully licensed and insured. No job is too big or too small.
Give them a call on 0438 564 015. Braidwood and Districts Plumbing, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Braidwood FM sponsor, Braidwood Air Conditioning, is your local air conditioning specialist for the installation and servicing of commercial and residential premises. Ryan is licensed and insured and has been in the industry for over 12 years. You can contact Ryan on 0405 274 227 or email him at info@braidwoodairconditioning.com.au or visit the website braidwoodairconditioning.com.au.
Well, we have been reading Ivanhoe, and we have reached an interesting point where the disinherited knight has done rather well. And the question now is, what will happen next? The shouts of the multitude, together with the acclamations of the heralds and the clangour of the trumpets, announced the triumph of the victors and the defeat of the vanquished. The former retreated to their pavilions, and the latter, gathering themselves up as they could, withdrew from the lists in disgrace and dejection, to agree with their victors concerning the redemption of their arms and their horses, which according to the laws of the tournament they had forfeited. The fifth of their number alone tarried in the lists long enough to be greeted by the applauses of the spectators, amongst whom he retreated, to the aggravation, doubtless, of his companions' mortification. A second and a third party of knights took the field, and although they had various success, yet upon the whole the advantage decidedly remained with the challengers, not one of whom lost his seat or swerved from his charge, misfortunes which befell one or two of their antagonists in each encounter. The spirits, therefore, of those opposed to them seemed to be considerably damped by their continued success. Three knights only appeared on the fourth entry, who, avoiding the shields of Bois Guilbert and Fontibourg, contented themselves with touching those of the three knights who had not altogether manifested the same strength and dexterity. This politic section did not alter the fortunes of the field. The challengers were still successful. One of their antagonists was overthrown, and both the others failed in the attaint, that is, in striking the helmet and shield of their antagonist firmly and strongly, with the lance held in a direct line, so that the weapon might break unless the champion was overthrown. After this fourth encounter, there was considerable pause, nor did it appear that anyone was very desirous of renewing the contest. The spectators murmured amongst themselves, for among the challengers, Malvoisin and Front de Boeuf were unpopular from their characters, and the others, except Grant Mesnil, were disliked as strangers and as foreigners. But none shared the general feeling of dissatisfaction so keenly as Cedric the Saxon, who saw in each advantage gained by the Norman challengers a repeated triumph over the honour of England. His own education had taught him no skill in the games of chivalry, although with the arms of his Saxon ancestors he had manifested himself on many occasions a brave and determined soldier. He looked anxiously to Athelstane, who had learned the accomplishments of the age, as if desiring that he should make some personal effort to recover the victory which was passing into the hands of the Templar and his associates. But though both stout of heart and strong of person, Athelstane had a disposition too inert and unambitious to make the exertions which Cedric seemed to expect from him. "The day is against England, my lord," said Cedric in a marked tone. "Are you not tempted to take the lance?"
"I shall tilt tomorrow," answered Athelstane, "in the melee. It's not worth while for me to arm myself today."
Two things displeased Cedric in this speech. It contained the Norman word melee to express the general conflict, and it evinced some indifference to the honour of the country, but it was spoken by Athelstane, whom he held in such profound respect that he would not trust himself to canvass his motives or his foibles. Moreover, he had no time to make any remark, for Wamba thrust in his word, observing,
"It was better, though scarce easier, to be the best man among 100 than the best man of 2.
Athelstane took the observation as a serious compliment, but Cedric, who better understood the jester's meaning, darted him a severe and menacing look, and lucky it was for Wamba, perhaps, that the time and the place prevented his receiving, notwithstanding his place and service, more sensible marks of his master's resentment. The pause in the tournament was still uninterrupted, except by the voices of the heralds exclaiming, "Love of ladies, splintering of lances, stand forth, gallant knights, fair eyes, look upon your deeds." The music also of the challengers breathed from time to time wild bursts expressive of triumph or defiance, while the clowns grudged a holiday which seemed to pass away in inactivity, and old knights and nobles lamented in whispers the decay of martial spirit, spoke of the triumphs of their younger days, but agreed that the land did not now supply dames of such transcendent beauty as had animated the jousts of former times. Prince John began to talk to his attendants about making ready the banquet and the necessity of adjudging the prize to Brian de Bois-Guilbert, who had, with a single spear, overthrown 2 knights and foiled a 3rd. At length, as the Saracenic music of the challengers concluded one of those long and high flourishes with which they had broken the silence of the lists, was answered by a solitary trumpet, which breathed a note of defiance from the northern extremity. All eyes were turned to see the new champion which these sounds announced, and no sooner were the barriers opened than he paced into the lists. As far as could be judged of a man sheathed in armour, the new adventurer did not greatly exceed the middle size, and seemed to be rather slender than strongly made. His suit of armour was formed of steel, richly inlaid with gold, and the device on his shield was a young oak tree pulled up by the roots, with the Spanish word Desdicado, signifying disinherited. He was mounted on a gallant black horse, and as he passed through the lists, he gracefully saluted the prince and the ladies by lowering his lance. The dexterity with which he managed his steed, and something of youthful grace which he displayed in his manner, won him the favour of the multitude, which some of the lower classes expressed by calling out, "Touch Ralph de Vipont's shield! Touch the Hospitaller's shield! He has the least sure seat. He's your cheapest bargain." The champion moved onward amid these well-meant hits, ascended the platform by the sloping alley which led to it from the lists, and to the astonishment of all present, riding straight up to the central pavilion, struck with the sharp end of his spear the shield of Brian de Bois-Guilbert until it rung again.
all stood astonished at his presumption, but none more than the redoubted knight, whom he had thus defied to mortal combat, and who, little expecting so rude a challenge, was standing carelessly at the door of the pavilion. "Have you confessed yourself, brother?" said the Templar. "And have you heard mass this morning, that you would peril your life so frankly?" "I am fitter to meet death than thou art," answered the disinherited knight, for by this name the stranger had recorded himself in the books of the tourney. "Then take your place in the lists," said Bois Guilbert, "and look your last upon the sun, for this night you will sleep in paradise." "Gramercy for thy courtesy," replied the disinherited knight, "and to requite it, I advise thee to take a fresh horse and a new lance, for by my honour, you will need both." Having expressed himself thus confidently, he reined his horse backward down the slope which he had ascended, and compelled him in the same manner to move backward through the lists, till he reached the northern extremity, where he remained stationary in expectation of his antagonist. This feat of horsemanship again attracted the applause of the multitude. However incensed at his adversary for the precautions which he recommended, Brian de Bois Guilbert did not neglect his advice, for his honour was too nearly concerned to permit his neglecting any means which might ensure victory over his presumptuous opponent. He changed his horse for a proved and fresh one of great strength and spirit. He chose a new and a tough spear, lest the wood of the former might have been strained in the previous encounters he had sustained. Lastly, he laid aside his shield, which had received some little damage, and received another from his squires. His first had only borne the general device of his rider, representing two knights riding upon one horse, an emblem expressive of the original humility and poverty of the Templars, qualities which they had since exchanged for the arrogance and wealth that finally occasioned their suppression. Bois Guilbert's new shield bore a raven in full flight, holding in its claws a skull. When the two champions stood opposed to each other at the two extremities of the lists, the public expectation was strained to the highest pitch. Few augured the possibility that the encounter would terminate well for the disinherited knight, yet his courage and gallantry secured the general good wishes of the spectators. The trumpets had no sooner given the signal than the champions vanished from their posts with the speed of lightning and closed in the centre of the lists with the shock of a thunderbolt. The lances burst into shivers up to the very grasp, and it seemed at the moment that both knights had fallen, for the shock had made each horse recoil backwards upon its haunches. The address of the riders recovered their steeds by the use of the bridle and spur, and having glared on each other for an instant with the eyes which seemed to flash fire through the bars of their visors, each made a demivolt, and, retiring to the extremity of the lists, received a fresh lance from the attendants. A loud shout from the spectators, waving of scarfs and handkerchiefs, and general acclamations attested the interest taken by the spectators in this encounter. The most equal, as well as the best performed, which had graced the day. But no sooner had the knights resumed their station than the clamour of applause was hushed into a silence so deep and so dead that it seemed the multitude were afraid even to breathe. A few minutes' pause having been allowed that the combatants and their horses might recover breath, Prince John, with his truncheon, signed to the trumpets to sound the onset. The champions a second time sprung from their stations and closed in the centre of the lists with the same speed, the same dexterity, the same violence, but not the same equal fortune as before. In this second encounter, the Templar aimed at the centre of his antagonist's shield and struck it so fair and forcibly that his spear went to shivers and the disinherited knight reeled in his saddle. On the other hand, that champion had, in the beginning of his career, directed the point of his lance towards Bois Guilbert's shield, but, changing his aim almost in the moment of encounter, he addressed it to the helmet, a mark more difficult to hit, but which, if attained, rendered the shock more irresistible. Fair and true he hit the Norman on the visor, where his lance's point kept hold of the bars. Yet even at this disadvantage, the Templar sustained his high reputation, and had not the girths of his saddle's burst he might not have been unhorsed. As it chanced, however, saddle, horse, and man rolled on the ground under a cloud of dust. To extricate himself from the stirrups and fallen steed was to the Templar scarce the work of a moment, and, stung with madness, both at his disgrace and at the acclamations which it was hailed by the spectators, he drew his sword and waved it in defiance of his conqueror. The Disinherited Knight sprung from his steed and also unsheathed his sword. The marshals of the field, however, spurred their horses between them and reminded them that the laws of the tournament did not, on the present occasion, permit this species of encounter. "We shall meet again, I trust," said the Templar, casting a resentful glance at his antagonist, "and where there are none to separate us." "If we do not," said the Disinherited Knight, "the fault shall not be mine. On foot or horseback, with spear, with axe, or with sword, I am alike ready to encounter you." More and angrier words would have been exchanged, but the marshals, crossing their lances between them, compelled them to separate. The Disinherited Knight returned to his first station, and was Gilbert to his tent, where he remained for the rest of the day in an agony of despair. Without alighting from his horse, the conqueror called for a bowl of wine, and opening the beaver or lower part of his helmet, announced, as he quaffed it, "To all true English hearts, and to the confusion of foreign tyrants." He then commanded his trumpet to sound a defiance to the challengers, and desired a herald to announce to them that he should make no election, but was willing to encounter them in the order in which they pleased to advance against him. The gigantic Front de Boeuf, armed in sable armour, was the first who took the field. He bore a white shield, a black bull's head, half defaced by the numerous encounters which he had undergone, and bearing an arrogant motto, Cave Adsum. Over this champion the Disinherited Knight obtained a slight but decisive advantage. Both knights broke their lances fairly, but Front de Boeuf, who lost a stirrup in the encounter, was adjudged to have the disadvantage. In the stranger's third encounter with Sir Philip Malvoisin, he was equally successful, striking that baron so forcibly on the casque that the laces of the helmet broke, and Malvoisin, only saved from falling by being unhelmeted, was declared vanquished like his companions. In his fourth combat with de Grantmesnil, the Disinherited Knight showed as much courtesy as he had hitherto evinced courage and dexterity. De Grantmesnil's horse, which was young and violent, reared and plunged in the course of the career so as to disturb the rider's aim, and the stranger, declining to take the advantage which this accident afforded him, raised his lance and, passing his antagonist without touching him, wheeled his horse and rode back again to his own end of the lists, offering his antagonist by a herald the chance of a second encounter. This de Grantmesnil declined, vowing himself vanquished as much by the courtesy as by the address of his opponent. Ralph de Vipont summed up the list of the stranger's triumphs, being hurled to the ground with such force that the blood gushed from his nose and his mouth, and he was borne senseless from the lists. The acclamations of thousands applauded the unanimous award of the prince and marshals, announcing that day's honours to the Disinherited Knight. Chapter 9. William de Wille and Stephen de Maurevel, the marshals of the field, were the first to offer their congratulations to the victor, praying him at the same time to suffer his helmet to be unlaced, or at least that he would raise his visor ere they conducted him to receive the prize of the day's tourney from the hands of Prince John. The Disinherited Knight, with all knightly courtesy, declined their request, alleging that he could not at this time suffer his face to be seen for reasons which he had assigned to the heralds when he entered the lists. The marshals were perfectly satisfied by this reply, for amidst the frequent and capricious vows by which knights were accustomed to bind themselves in the days of chivalry, there were none more common than those by which they engaged to remain incognito for a certain space or until some particular adventure was achieved. The marshals, therefore, pressed no further into the mystery of the Disinherited Knight, but announcing to Prince John the conqueror's desire to remain unknown, they requested permission to bring him before his grace in order that he might receive the reward of his valour. John's curiosity was excited by the mystery observed by the stranger, and being already displeased with the issue of the tournament in which the challengers whom he favoured. had been successively defeated by one knight, he answered naughtily to the marshals, "By the light of Our Lady's brow, this same knight hath been disinherited as well of his courtesy as of his lands, since he desires to appear before us without uncovering his face. Watch ye, my lords," he said, turning round to his train, "who this gallant can be that bears himself thus proudly." "I cannot guess," answered De Bracy, "nor did I think there had been within the four seas that girth Britain's champion that could bear down these five knights in one day's jousting. By my faith, I shall never forget the force which he shocked De Vipon. The poor hospitaller was hurled from his saddle like a stone from a sling." "Boast not of that," said a knight of St. John, who was present. "Your temple champion had no better luck. I saw your brave lance, Bois Guilbert, roll thrice over, grasping his hands full of sand at every turn." De Bracy, being attached to the Templars, would have replied, but was prevented by Prince John. "Silence, sirs," he said. "What unprofitable debate have we here?" "The victor," said De Wivel, "still waits the pleasure of your highness." "It is our pleasure," answered John, "that he do so wait until we learn whether there is not someone who can at least guess at his name and quality. Should he remain there till nightfall, he has had work enough to keep him warm." "Your Grace," said Waldemar Fitzurse, "will do less than due honour to the victor if you compel him to wait till we tell your highness that which we cannot know. At least I can form no guess, unless he be one of the good lancers who accompanied King Richard to Palestine, and who are now straggling homeward from the Holy Land." "It may be the Earl of Salisbury," said De Bracy. "He's about the same pitch." "Sir Thomas Moulton, the Knight of Gilsland, rather," said Fitzurse. "Salisbury is bigger in the bones." A whisper arose among the train, but by whom first suggested could not be ascertained. It might be the king. It might be Richard Coeur d'Alene himself. "Over God's forbode," said Prince John, involuntarily turning at the same time, as pale as death and shrinking as if blighted by a flash of lightning. "Waldemar, De Bracy, brave knights and gentlemen, remember your promises and stand truly by me." "Here is no danger impending," said Waldemar Fitzurse. "Are you so little acquainted with the gigantic limbs of your father's son as to think they can be held within the circumference of yonder suit of armour? De Wivel and Maurevel, you will best serve the prince by bringing forward the victor to the throne, and ending an era that has conjured all the blood from his cheeks. Look at him more closely," he continued. "Your highness will see that he wants 3 inches of King Richard's height and twice as much of his shoulder breadth. The very horse he backs could not have carried the ponderous weight of King Richard through a single course." While he was yet speaking, the marshals brought forward the disinherited knight to the foot of a wooden flight of steps, which formed the ascent from the lists to Prince John's throne. Still discomposed with the idea that his brother so much injured, and to whom he was so much indebted, had suddenly arrived in his native kingdom, even the distinctions pointed out by Fitzurse did not altogether remove the prince's apprehensions. And while, with a short and embarrassed eulogy upon his valour, he caused to be delivered to him the war horse, the mailed form before him, an answer might be returned in the deep and awful accents of Richard the Lion-hearted. But the disinherited knight spoke not a word in reply to the compliment of the prince, which he only acknowledged with a profound obeisance. The horse was led into the lists by 2 grooms richly dressed, the animal itself being fully accoutred with the richest war furniture, which, however, scarcely added to the value of the noble creature in the eyes of those who were judges. Laying one hand upon the pommel of the saddle, the disinherited knight vaulted at once upon the back of the steed without making use of the stirrup, and brandishing aloft his lance, rode twice around the lists, exhibiting the points and paces of the horse with the skill of a perfect horseman. The appearance of vanity, which might otherwise have been attributed to this display, was removed by the propriety shown in exhibiting the best advantage, the princely reward with which he had just been honoured, and the knight was again greeted by the acclamations of all present. In the meanwhile, the bustling prior of Jorvel had reminded Prince John in a whisper that the victor must now display his good judgment instead of his valour, by selecting from among the beauties who graced the galleries a lady who should fill the throne of the Queen of Beauty and Love and deliver the prize of the tourney upon the ensuing day. The prince accordingly made a sign with his truncheon as the knight passed him in his second career around the lists. The knight turned towards the throne and, sinking his lance until the point was within a foot of the ground, remained motionless as if expecting John's commands, while all admired the sudden dexterity with which he instantly reduced his fiery steed from a state of violent emotion and high excitation to the stillness of an equestrian statue. "Sir Disinherited Knight," said Prince John, "since that is the only title by which we can address you, it is now your duty as well as privilege to name the fair lady who, as Queen of Honour and Love, is to preside over the next day's festival. If, as a stranger in our land, you should require the aid of other judgment to guide your own, we can only say that Alicia, the daughter of our gallant knight, Waldemere Fitzurse, has at our court been long held the first in beauty as in place. Nevertheless, it is your undoubted prerogative to confer on whom you please this crown, by the delivery of which to the lady of your choice the election of tomorrow's queen will be formal and complete. Raise your lance." The knight obeyed, and Prince John placed upon its point a coronet of green satin, having around its edge a circlet of gold, the upper edge of which was relieved by arrow points and hearts placed interchangeably, like the strawberry leaves and balls upon a ducal crown. In the broad hint which he dropped respecting the daughter of Waldemere Fitzurse, John had more than one motive, each the offspring of a mind which was a strange mixture of carelessness and presumption, with low artifice and cunning. He wished to banish from the minds of the chivalry around him his own indecent and unacceptable jest respecting the Jewess Rebecca. He was desirous of conciliating Alicia's father, Waldemar, of whom he stood in awe, and who had more than once shown himself dissatisfied during the course of the day's proceedings. He had also a wish to establish himself in the good graces of the lady, for John was at least as licentious in his pleasures as profligate in his ambition. But besides all these reasons, he was desirous to raise up against the disinherited knight, towards whom he had already entertained a strong dislike, a powerful enemy in the person of Waldemar Fitzurse, who was likely, he thought, highly to resent the injury done to his daughter, in case, as was not unlikely, the victor should make another choice. And so indeed it proved, for the disinherited knight passed the gallery close to that of the prince, in which Lady Alicia was seated in the full pride of triumphant beauty, and pacing forwards as slowly as he had hitherto rode swiftly round the lists, he seemed to exercise his right of examining the numerous fair faces which adorned that splendid circle. It was worthwhile to see the different conduct of the beauties who underwent this examination during the time it was proceeding. Some blushed, some assumed an air of pride and dignity, some looked straight forward and essayed to be seen to be utterly unconscious of what was going on, some drew back in alarm, which was perhaps affected, some endeavoured to forbear smiling, and there were two or three who laughed outright. There were also some who dropped their veils over their charms, but, as the Wardour manuscript says, these were fair ones of 10 years' standing. It may be supposed that, having had their full share of such vanities, they were willing to withdraw their claim in order to give a fair chance to the rising beauties of the age. At length the champion paused beneath the balcony in which the Lady Rowena was placed, and the expectation of the spectators was excited to the utmost. It must be owned that if an interest displayed in his success could have bribed the disinherited knight, the part of the lists before which he paused had merited his predilection. Cedric the Saxon, overjoyed at the discomfiture of the Templar, and still more so at the miscarriage of his two malevolent neighbours, Front de Boeuf and Malvoisin, had, with his body half stretched over the balcony, accompanied the victor in each course, not with his eyes only, but with his whole heart and soul. The Lady Rowena had watched the progress of the day with equal attention, though without openly betraying the same intense interest. Even the unmoved Athelstane had shown symptoms of shaking off his apathy when calling for a huge goblet of muscadine, which he quaffed to the health of the disinherited knight. Another group, stationed under the gallery occupied by the Saxons, had shown no less interest in the fate of the day. "Father Abraham," said Isaac of York, when the first course was run betwixt the Templar and the disinherited knight, "how fiercely the Gentile rides! Ah, the good horse that was bought all the long way from Barbary. He takes no more care of him than if he were a wild ass's colt. And the noble armour that is worth so many zecchins to Joseph Paria, the armour of Milan, besides 70 and 100 of profits, he cares for it as little as if he had found it on the highways."
"If he risks his own person and limbs, father," said Rebecca, "in doing such dreadful battle, he can scarce be expected to spare his horse and armour."
"Child," replied Isaac, somewhat heated, "thou knowest not what thou speakest. His neck and limbs are his own, but his horse and armour belong to... Holy Jacob, what was I about to say? Nevertheless, it is a good youth. See, Rebecca, see, he is again about to go up to battle against the Philistine. Pray, child, pray for the safety of the good youth and of the speedy horse and the rich armour. God of my fathers," he again exclaimed, "he hath conquered, and the uncircumcised Philistine hath fallen before his lance, even as Og the king of Bashan and Sihon king of the Amorites fell before the sword of our fathers. Surely he will take their gold and their silver and their war horses and their armour of brass and of steel for a prey and for a spoil."
The same anxiety did the worthy Jew display during every course that was run, seldom failing to hazard a hasty calculation concerning the value of the horse and armour which was forfeited to the champion upon each new success. There had been, therefore, no small interest taken in the success of the disinherited knight by those who occupied the part of the lists before which he now paused. Whether from indecision or some other motive of hesitation, the champion of the day remained stationary for more than a minute, while the eyes of the silent audience were riveted upon his motions, and then, gradually and gracefully, sinking the point of his lance, he deposited the coronet which it supported at the feet of the fair Rowena. The trumpets instantly sounded, while the heralds proclaimed the Lady Rowena, the Queen of Beauty and Love, for the ensuing day, menacing with suitable penalties those who should be disobedient to her authority. They then repeated their cry of "La Guesse," to which Cedric, in the height of his joy, replied by an ample donative, and to which Athelstane, though less promptly, added one equally large. There was some murmuring among the damsels of Norman descent, who were as much mused to see the preference given to a Saxon beauty as the Norman nobles were to sustain defeat in the games of chivalry which they themselves had introduced. But these sounds of dissatisfaction were drowned by the popular shout of "Long live the Lady Rowena, the chosen and lawful queen of love and beauty," to which many in the lower area added, "Long live the Saxon princess, long live the race of the immortal Alfred." However unacceptable these sounds might be to Prince John and to those around him, he saw himself, nevertheless, obliged to confirm the nomination of the victor. Accordingly, calling to horse, he left his throne, and mounting his jennet, accompanied by his train, he again entered the lists. The prince paused a moment beneath the gallery of the Lady Alicia, to whom he paid his compliments, observing at the same time to those around him, "By my halidome, sirs, if the knight's feats in arms have shown that he hath limbs and sinews, his choice has no less proved that his eyes are none of the clearest." It was on this occasion, as during his whole life, John's misfortune not perfectly to understand the characters of those whom he wished to conciliate. Waldemere Fitzurse was rather offended than pleased at the prince stating thus broadly an opinion that his daughter had been slighted. "I know no right of chivalry," he said, "more precious or inalienable than that of each free knight to choose his lady love by his own judgment. My daughter courts distinction from no one, and in her own chamber and in her own sphere will never fail to receive the full proportion of that which is her due." Prince John replied, not but spurring his horse, as if to give vent to his vexation, he made the animal bound forward to the gallery where Rowena was seated, with the crown still at her feet. "Assume," he said, "fair lady, the mark of your sovereignty, to which none bows homage more sincerely than ourself, John of Anjou. And if it please you today, with your noble sire and friends, to grace our banquet in the castle of Ashby, we shall learn to know the empress of whose service we devote tomorrow." Rowena remained silent, and Cedric answered for her in his native Saxon. "The Lady Rowena," he said, "possesses not the language in which to reply to your courtesy or to sustain her part in your festival. I also and the noble Athelstane of Koningsberg speak only the language and practice only the manners of our fathers. We therefore decline with thanks your Highness's courteous invitation to the banquet. Tomorrow the Lady Rowena will take upon her the state to which she has been called by the free election of the victor knight, confirmed by the acclamations of the people." So saying, he lifted the coronet and placed it upon Rowena's head in token of her acceptance of the temporary authority assigned to her.
What says he?" said Prince John, affecting not to understand the Saxon language, in which, however, he was well skilled.
The purport of Cedric's speech was repeated to him in French. "It is well," he said. "Tomorrow we will, ourself, conduct this mute sovereign to her seat of dignity. You at least, Sir Knight," he added, turning to the victor, who had remained near the gallery, "will this day share our banquet?" The knight, speaking for the first time, in a low and hurried voice, excused himself by pleading fatigue and the necessity of preparing for tomorrow's encounter. "It is well," said John haughtily, "although unused to such refusals, we will endeavour to digest our banquet as we may, though ungraced by the most successful in arms and his elected Queen of Beauty." So saying, he prepared to leave the lists with his glittering train, and his turning his steed for that purpose was the signal for the breaking up and dispersion of the spectators. Yet with the vindictive memory proper to offended pride, especially when combined with conscious want of desert, John had hardly proceeded 3 paces ere again turning around, he fixed an eye of stern resentment upon the yeoman who had displeased him in the early part of the day, and issued his commands to the men-at-arms who stood near. "On your life, suffer that fellow not to escape." The yeoman stood the angry glance of the prince with the same unvaried steadiness which had marked his former deportment, saying with a smile, "I have no intention to leave Ashby until the day after tomorrow. I must see how Staffordshire and Leicestershire can draw their bows. The forests of Needwood and Charnwood must rear good archers." "I," said Prince John to his attendants, but not in direct reply, "I will see how he can draw his own, and we betide him, unless his skill should prove some apology for his insolence." "It is full time," said De Bracy, "that the presumption, the insolence of these peasants should be restrained by some striking example." Waldemere Fitzurse, who probably thought his patron was not taking the readiest road to popularity, shrugged up his shoulders and was silent. Prince John resumed his retreat from the lists, and the dispersion of the multitude became general. In various routes, according to the different quarters from which they came, and in groups of various numbers, the spectators were seen retiring over the plain. By far the most numerous parts streamed towards the town of Ashby, where many of the distinguished persons were lodged in the castle. Among these were most of the knights who had already appeared in the tournament, or who proposed to fight there the ensuing day, and who, as they rode slowly along, talking over the events of the day, were greeted with loud shouts by the populace. The same acclamations were bestowed upon Prince John, although he was indebted for them rather to the splendour of his appearance and train than to the popularity of his character. A more sincere and more general, as well as better merited, acclamation attended the victor of the day, until, anxious to withdraw himself from popular notice, he accepted the accommodation of one of those pavilions pitched at the extremities of the lists, the use of which was courteously tendered him by marshals of the field. On his retiring to his tent, many who had lingered in the lists to look upon the form, conjectures concerning him also dispersed. The signs and sounds of a tumultuous concourse of men, completely crowded together in one place and agitated by the same passing events, were now exchanged for the distant hum of voices of different groups retreating in all directions, and these speedily died away in silence. No other sounds were heard save the voices of the menials who stripped the galleries of their cushions and tapestry in order to put them in safety for the night, and wrangled among themselves for the half-used bettles of wine and relics of the refreshments which had been served round to the spectators. Beyond the precincts of the lists, more than one forge was erected, and these now began to glimmer through the twilight, announcing the toil of the armourers, which was to continue through the whole night,
in order to repair or alter the suits of armour to be used again on the morrow. A strong guard of men-at-arms, renewed at intervals from 2 hours to 2 hours, surrounded the lists and kept watch during the night. Till next week, Braidwood, when we continue on.